Comics.
Movies.
Music.
Video games.
Technology.
Blu-ray.
Television.
This is the HHW LOD Podcast Network.
Now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and Abe is on break, but this is another one of our Out Now bonus commentary episodes, and the final of our Bond commentaries, unless we decide to return to Bond commentaries in a future way. But as anyone that has listened to these already or might be familiar, I, myself, and my two guests, who I'll introduce in a second, have been doing commentaries for various Bond movies. We've done one Sean Connery one with one Russia with Love. We've done one Roger Moore one with Moonraker, the underrated Moonraker. We've done one for GoldenEye with Pierce Brosnan. And now we're jumping into Daniel Craig territory with Quantum of Solace. And joining me, as always, for this special Bond commentary episode, we have the writer for Mendelsohn's Memos and Huffington Post, a man who is living in strawberry fields forever, Scott Mendelsohn.
Sorry, Timothy, we just didn't have time for you. We love you, we really do, but sacrifices must be made.
And guest writer for Mendelsohn's Memos, who has now finished his recapping of all of the Bond films with detailed retrospectives, the badly edited Brandon Peters.
Oh, but it's so badly edited, it's so good.
Okay, so...
Some pieces are better edited than others. Depends on how much time I had in a given day.
So, we're gonna get right into this here. We're talking about Quantum of Solace, the second in line of Daniel Craig Bond movies, of course, the first being Casino Royale, and the upcoming Skyfall being next, which is going to be reviewed by myself, Abe, and Brandon and Scott, which is what we've all been working towards anyway. That's the plan, so we are going to do that, and we, as always, have it kind of all synced together. Each of us have it right, have the movie Quantum of Solace playing, like, right when the lion is roaring. That's about 5 seconds in for myself and Brandon on the Blu-ray. Scott, do you have the DVD or the Blu-ray?
Yeah, DVD.
Okay. Yeah, so we're all like, the lion's like mid-roar right now, so I'm going to count down from 3, 2, 1, go, and then we're just going to get into it. So on the sound of go, we all press play. So, okay, are we ready? 3, 2, 1, go. All right. So, all right.
Start us off, please.
I already know that I am not a big fan of this movie. I don't hate this movie. I don't think it's the worst Bond movie. But coming off of Casino Royale, which I also watched again last night, and then come and, you know, go to whatever, what, 4 years ago? 3 years ago, this movie was what I called my biggest disappointment of 2009.
Well, that's good because it came out in 2008.
It was 2008. Oh, okay. Well, so 2008 was my biggest disappointment of that year. It left me unsatisfied. I know you two are much bigger fans of the movie. What do you guys have to say about Quantum of Solace? Early thoughts on it?
I left the theater. I was fine with it. I enjoyed it. Thought it was rather quick and threw a lot of stuff at the audience. I mean, pretty heavy-handed, really fast. But I enjoyed it, and my whole group, who were, pretty, notable cinema fans, enjoyed it as well. The people I talked to outside of it the next week seemed to enjoy it, and then, like, a year later, I discovered it was hated.
Scott?
The critical feedback right away was somewhat negative. I like it. I think it is, taken apart from its lineage as a Bond film, I think it is a well-acted, well-written, thoughtful, character-driven action thriller with some rather hearty political content. You could carp that there are pieces of Bond that are missing. It's a very short film. You could argue that it's Bond without the, I don't want to say the fat, because that's a negative statement, but it's a very lean, mean James Bond film. And my argument for it has always been, there's been 22, 23 of these up to this point. It's okay that one of them is like Quantum of Solace. Would I want every Bond film to be like this? No. but one of them is okay.
I agree there.
This car, you know, my only problem with the film, frankly, one of my only problems has been the quick cutted nature of the action sequences, which if you're watching this, you're seeing an incredibly fast cut car chase. And yes, there is a certain, you know, let's try to make it more like a, as Brandon said, a Jason Bourne film or a Jason Statham thriller. And, you know, as you know, if you've been reading his essays, a lot of the Bond films are sort of, let's emulate something else in the Bond mold. So I don't mind that this is somewhat emulating a Jason Bourne film, both in terms of its action and in terms of its, you know, political subtext. It's sort of its you know, gray morality and its very, you know, downbeat nature, because, well, this is just James Bond playing in the Bourne sandbox. Let's see what he plays in next time.
Now, okay, so I understand a lot of those points being made, and like my biggest issue is similarly, yes, the editing of this movie, it's specifically designed to kind of model the kind of action movies that are coming out at this time, which are Bourne movies and Jason Statham movies, where they are tightly edited. That doesn't, I mean, regardless of the fact that it's emulating much what's going on right now in terms of kind of spy thrillers, it much like other Bond movies model what's going on, it doesn't make it a good movie to me necessarily. Like it doesn't get a pass for me just because it feels like another movie that came out at this time. I still think the editing makes the film suffer. Also, Scott, you mentioned that there are pieces of Bond missing in this movie because it is a lean, mean Bond movie, and that does bug me. Like it's shaking things up with the franchise and what have you, but I came into a Bond movie, I wanted to see a Bond movie, and I just don't feel like I got that movie.
Is that me? Hello?
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm hearing like stepping or something. Anyway, I think it's a good film. Obviously, if I didn't think it was a good film, I would say, oh, it's a bad film, but it's okay because it's trying to be Bourne. I would say, and I know you disagree with me on at least part of this, I think Quantum of Solace is a better film than at least two of the Bourne films. You know, I'm not a fan of Bourne Ultimatum. I'm certainly not a fan of the Bourne Legacy.
It's better than Bourne Legacy. I'll give you that.
Yes. Most things are. And my only problem is the shaky action editing. I think the action scenes themselves are actually terrific. There's plenty of very natural, you know, real stunt work, terrific location shooting. And frankly, watching it on a small, as I am on a computer monitor, it's actually easier to that's the ironic thing about the super quick cut, you know, Paul Greengrass, Chris Nolan style editing, is it's actually easier to follow on a TV than it is in a movie theater.
Agreed.
Which is frustrating because obviously it shouldn't be the case. But I think aside from the action scenes, which are good if poorly edited, I think the rest of the movie is good if not very good.
I think the one good action scene in this movie, which we'll get to, is the opera house sequence.
I love that. Yes,
I think that's the highlight of the movie. But we'll get there when we get there.
I don't mind the car chase at the beginning. I think it works for the most part. I mean, it is a little bit fast and stuff, but kind of ramps up the intensity a bit.
Even watching that now, I'm still like, I want to like it. Like I didn't like. I came into this movie wanting to love it. I came into this movie, you know, after Casino Royale, thinking, okay, let's hit the ground running. And the car chase, like, when I first saw it in theaters, it left a bad taste in my mouth, and it's like, because I was literally thinking, and my friend next to me also, he, who's much more opinionated than I am, he, in terms of what he likes versus what he doesn't like, we both kind of were like, is this what the whole movie's going to look like? Because I hope not. It's just, it's really fast to me. It just seems, like, noticeably fast. And I don't have problems with these movies like the Bourne film. I mean, the Bourne films, they're handled much better. I think Greengrass has a good handle on how to make that work effectively. But even just, like, the Luc Besson school of, like, heavily edited movies, like, it falls into that Columbiana range where it's just all these cuts are happening and it just doesn't feel great.
Yeah, I guess maybe I was just surprised. I didn't expect something that with that level of intensity right off the bat. Mm-hmm. So maybe it took me by a nice surprise after the previous film was rather, you know, slow. It had like a fist fight and Bond sitting stalking a guy at his desk. I mean, you come into this and it's bam. And then they reveal right after that that, you know, hey, we just picked up couple minutes later.
I do like the idea of this, of like how this movie set up story wise. It is basically like the last two acts of Casino Royale. That's what this movie is. Like it's less of a new Bond adventure and more of a here's a very expanded epilogue to go to kind of cap up this Bond adventure that we told most of, but Casino Royale was already running 2.5 hours, so it's like might as well pick it up later on. Like,
and that's why I think it's cool. There's once again no true gun barrel sequence at the beginning of this because it's really picking up and finishing off another story.
Yeah. And I like that idea. But even, like, we're going to get to another action sequence here, and it feels like it just jumps, it keeps jumping right into things. And I get, yeah, it's trimming the fat, as I mean, I'll put that in quotation marks, but it's trimming off, like, you know, Bond gets somewhere, he gets exposition, he deals with people, you're getting straight to what's, you know, supposed to matter in this high-octane Bond adventure action movie. But it feels like a lot. It feels like I'm getting a lot of action, and a lot of action I'm not too fond of in a Bond movie where I want to see more of Daniel Craig be suave and be Bond and not be this guy who's becoming Bond. And, like, I'll let you guys talk now, but
I agree that the action is on. I mean, the plot and the action is on overload, and it can be kind of hard for people to comprehend. I've not had a hard time taking it all in. I understand some people have complained that they can't follow what's going on in the action sequences, and there's some people that have not understood the plot at all, and because they're both being just thrust on you at a fast pace and constantly throughout the film. But I personally, maybe I don't see eye to eye with that because I've had no problem keeping along with this movie. I'm not saying I'm some sort of superhuman being. I found myself able to pick up on it. And there's a lot of stuff I wasn't, maybe did I pick this up right? Did I figure this out? And I, going through viewing it again and reading, I did pick it up. But I did leave going, did I get everything out of that? I will admit that, but...
When I watched this movie the first time, again, I wasn't too into it. I was falling in love with what happens, and I felt like I got a good handle on the story. I had the option to see it a second time with my father, who's a big Bond fan himself. When I got into the theater, I was watching it. I just didn't care, honestly. I was watching it. I just felt like it was just too relentless for me to want to keep up with it. And I was literally just unengaged with the movie the second time seeing it. It wasn't like a movie I felt like I wanted to continue trying to pick up little details I might have missed the second time. Instead, I just decided to check out. Like, that was my reaction.
Well, I didn't. I mean, I saw it the first time in the theater, and I didn't see it again for another year. I mean. But at that time, it was a different time in my life. I was moving across the country, so I didn't have time to go.
I'll say this as well, though. When a new Bond movie comes out, much like I've done this past few weeks, especially with these commentaries, I watch all my Bond movies because I love Bond movies. I like watching the Bond movies, and so like I would like to think that because I've watched all these Bond movies, that I'd be happy with the idea of this movie, which is much different than the average Bond movie. But still, it didn't win me over in that sense of like, oh, I'm getting something different here. That didn't make me respond well. I don't know if it's just because I'm a slave to formula, but I like the Bond formula a lot.
Yeah. This film is reminding me a lot what the film's basis and reception-wise to License to Kill. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, it's a out-and-out revenge story. But this time, unlike License to Kill, the revenge is kind of on the back burner to the main plot a bit, rather than being the sole focus. But also people, not liking it, and it's different and not what I wanted. It's the same complaints of License to Kill, which people are going back now and going, that wasn't that bad.
Well, I think, part of that is, with License to Kill, again, it's like what Aaron said, it isn't what you wanted in a Bond film. And I think there was a certain extent, at least 4 years ago, are they all going to be like this from this point on? After License to Kill, we get Gold, the Brosnan films, which are not License to Kill, shall we say. So it's easier to appreciate, a somewhat irregular entry like License to Kill when, okay, this is sort of a one-off. there are many more after this that were not like this.
And I think people may look back on this one like that as well.
Super tight, all this action.
And, you know, without, you know, anyway, what I like about this scene, first of all, is the stunt work's just incredible. You know, I wish I could appreciate it a bit more. Agreed. If it wasn't cut so tightly.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are real stunt people doing just phenomenal stunt work here. Yeah. We're about to see what's going to be somewhat of a, for lack of a better word, a running gag, which is that, you know, M constantly berates Bond for killing people, even though A, he's got a license to kill. That's kind of what he does.
But,
and B, most of the time, they're somewhat self-defense.
And that's another issue I have with this movie, too. I think M is way too harsh on Bond, and Bond just sits there and takes it on the chin. He's like, oh, you know, well, I just, it happened. Especially later on in the scene, too, where after it's like the end of that Opera House chase action sequence where he, there's literally nothing he could have done about a certain character that dies, and then he just kind of lets it ride when M just completely disowns him for what he's not done.
Well, and then you know, I assume everybody here has seen the movie. You know, the guy that falls off the roof of the Opera House and then the other bad guy shoots him, you know, when M tells him that he's been shot, at no point does he say, huh, that's strange.
Exactly.
Well, I think also he maybe thinks, I'm not getting out of this one and I need to continue with this, so sitting and arguing here is pointless. And Mark Forrester says, let's move along, please.
Yes.
Now, with the action, again, I just watched Casino Royale yesterday, but I mean, even when I first saw this movie, I probably watched it right before I saw it too. Martin Campbell directs the hell out of that movie. Like, that movie looks great.
Oh, yeah.
All the action clearly registers. It's wonderful. It's just like GoldenEye's really good, but like Mask of Zorro is a movie I hold up to high standards too in terms of his action, because you just see these great, like, long shots that are shot from a distance of, like, so the sword action in that movie is just constant. Yeah. Like, it's, you see all the moves going. It's not cut. So Casino Royale has that same kind of attitude where you just see so many great, like, wide shots of the action that's taking place right now. So you get to this movie, and I mean, it's such a different pace. It's such a different kind of frame of mind to watch a Bond movie like this, where you just came from this wonderful action movie with set piece after set piece that looks great, to get to this more tightly shot, well, differently edited movie that, sure, has, you know, there's certainly a lot of work went into it, and sure, there's a lot of great stunts actually happening, but I couldn't appreciate it as much as I would have liked to.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, Martin Campbell is, you know, a classic action director in the sense that he's always about wide shots, clear geography. You know, it's one of the reasons I'm such a huge Martin Campbell fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's no secret that The Mask of Zorro is probably my favorite superhero movie, period. And for what it's worth, it was, you know, I had seen the film in theaters twice, and it was seeing it projected on a DVD widescreen television that convinced me to get a DVD player.
Nice.
Because, you know, I had my, you know, pan and scan copy like everybody else did back in the day. I was like, I need to get a DVD player at some point. But no, I is this film as good as Casino Royale? Absolutely not. For reasons both aesthetically, in terms of like the action and then the pacing, and for some plot issues, as, you know, it's a little silly that she keeps berating him for, you know, oh no, you shot this guy clearly in self-defense. I do like in the scene, you know, just preceding this, it's the at least the second Bond film in several years where M is standing in a room and some guy who she trusts pulls out a gun and shoots everybody in the room but her.
Yeah.
He misses her. There's a ricochet off the IV.
Judi Dench has a force field built around her.
Yes, she does.
Yeah, I think that happened in the Chronicles of Riddick also.
We can't see it, and neither can she.
Exactly.
It comes also with the occurred elements. In the best exotic Marigold Hotel.
Oh, see, I have to review that Blu-ray still.
I
haven't watched it yet. Yeah. Bill Nye tries to shoot her, right? That's the end.
Tom Wilkinson is in on it.
Then he goes crazy because he's bipolar and gets assassinated.
Yes. That's a great movie.
I love Michael Clayton. I can. It's surprising how much I can watch that movie. Okay, so you brought up License to Kill before, and I think License to Kill is the closest Bond movie to this film. Is that fair to say? I'm trying to think of other. I don't think any other Bond movie.
I think to a certain extent, you know, it's an interesting, you know, two film comparison here, because you've got, you know, The Living Daylights and Casino Royale. that were technically, you know, Bond films for the respective stars, but weren't arguably as uniquely suited to the specific actor. And then, you know, the second film, once they're comfortable in the role, you get what you could arguably consider, you know, License to Kill is a hardcore Timothy Dalton Bond film. And to a certain extent, Quantum of Solace is, you know, a hardcore Daniel Craig Bond film. And, you know, it's, you know, situations like that where you could argue that it's sometimes better to have a little bit of, I don't want to say genericness here. You know, it's like the obvious comparison of, you know, Batman, Tim Burton's Batman being sort of a mix of franchise plus personal project. And then you get to Batman Returns, which is hardcore Tim Burton.
Yeah.
Which, you know, turned off a lot of people.
Yeah. And I've argued that Batman Returns is always one of the most Tim Burton films that you can have. But
yes. I think it's one of his best films, period. As much as I adore the original Batman, it's one of my favorite films. And still holds up. I actually caught a big chunk of it while I was putting my kid to sleep the other night. It's even better if you look at it as a 1940s period piece. But anyway, we are now watching Daniel Craig break into an apartment.
Okay, with License to Kill. Oh, yeah. Sorry, was there a specific thing that you were going to...
No, that was it.
Okay, with License to Kill, even that movie at least has humor. I mean, it's not devoid of like its own little self-awareness of what kind of movie it is. This movie just also seems incredibly serious, which is another thing.
We're about to get one of my favorite gags of the movie coming up.
Okay,
it's not. It's after the spite, but
the another action scene.
Yeah,
I never thought I'd complain about too many action scenes in a Bond movie, but it's nonstop in this movie.
It's one big chase.
I never liked the title cards, by the way, when you get to each city.
Eh, they don't bother me.
Just throw that out there.
That's when you're trying to hate on the movie.
No, I'm not trying
to.
It seems like it's too much. It seems like they're just like just
they don't. If the film, they're too pretty for a film edited like this. I'll give it that.
Thank you. Okay.
No, there's a lot of good, like beautiful shots in this movie that they could linger on. They just don't, and then it does feel awkward when they do linger on a shot. Like trying to catch your breath or something, but you know that is my, you know, one of my complaints with the film is the editing. I mean, it's about obvious, but sometimes it works and a lot of times it doesn't.
It is interesting, but you know, we're 20 minutes into the film, we've already had three action sequences.
Yeah. here's a Bond gag.
This isn't it, but no, it's. Spoiler alert, it's when he knocks the guy off the motorcycle. I find that hilarious.
Oh. Doesn't he say something, too? He has, like, a line.
Yeah.
Why is Sean Connery sitting right in that chair? Cameo. Cameo alert, guys. I'm not a big fan of Olga Kurylenko.
No?
Either or.
I'm indifferent, but I was rather surprised by her.
I've yet to like her in anything between Max Payne and Hitman in this movie.
Well, to be fair, Max Payne and Hitman, and in your opinion, this aren't very good movies.
Yeah, but it helps. But I mean, it feels like she was like suddenly escalated into like leading lady stat. Like she has like Sam Worthington syndrome to me, where she's just like inexplicably in the lead things, but like not charismatic at all.
I would say the same thing about the other woman in this film, actually.
Yes.
Oh, Gail Arterton,
Who is a much, you know, higher profile name at this point. You know, she's top lining, you know, Hansel and Gretel and the Revenge of the Stupid or whatever it is.
I agree, but at least she has a Bond girl name, Strawberry Fields, as opposed
to true.
Camille. That's her name in this movie. Camille.
That's actually one of the things I really like about this film, and I know this is jumping ahead about an hour. Well, 45 minutes, is when Strawberry Fields is killed, it actually matters. The characters react to her violent, you know, horrible murder. You know, there's a lot of Bond films where the death of the secondary female is almost sort of, you know, tossed aside as irrelevant.
And surprising because her character is presented as pretty much silly, too.
Yes.
I would say, though, in the better Bond films, the secondary Bond girl that does or does not meet her maker... does give us a significant reaction. Even like Tomorrow Never Dies has a There's the Bond gag.
Sorry, I find that funny.
I just Even Savara Never Dies has a solid performance by Terry Hatcher in a small role.
Yes.
She's reflected on it.
And it does matter. Yes.
And that's one of the reasons I like the film.
I mean, again, I certainly don't hate this movie. I think it had a lot to live up to and didn't meet that nearly as much as I could have hoped for.
Following Casino Royale, are you really going to?
Yeah.
But it
doesn't help that it's a movie you can't like really watch on its own. Like, it's not like I'm gonna pop in Quantum of Solace just because. I mean, if I have to pop in Casino Royale, and if I feel like, hey, maybe I should get into the end of the storyboard, then I'll pop in Quantum of Solace, maybe. But
it depends how much time you have.
I think it stands enough on its own. I mean, all you have to know is
Vesper died.
That's it, you know. And, you know, arguably you'd say the same thing for Diamonds Are Forever, which is also a terrible Bond film, so maybe it's a bad example.
Yeah.
But, yeah. that all you need to know is his wife died at the end of the last film. Okay, cool.
And you only need to know that for the first 5 minutes.
Pretty much.
I guess if I'm going to watch an action movie and I want to watch a Bond movie, this isn't the movie I'm going to pick up. If I want to watch an action movie from this kind of year...
Yeah,
this era, I'm gonna pick up a Bourne movie. Like, it's not.
Yeah,
this is the movie I'm reaching for ever. This guy, what's his name? What's this actor's name?
I have no idea.
Character is Dominic Green.
Dominic Green, which is completely different from what his name is. Mattel Almeric. He was in Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and I was the reason I was excited to see this movie too, because I'm like, well, he's amazing in that movie, so clearly he's a Bond villain, I can see that, and then he shrieks with an axe at the end, and it's hilarious.
They went for way too real with this guy, it's just no fun.
And he has crazy eyes.
Yeah, they listen, oh, he's got eyes like the devil, okay.
No kidding.
Well, no, I think it was, you know, and whether it works or not... Like License to Kill is an attempt to dial back the villainy to something, you know, plausible and real world, you know, relatable. And I think that's, you know, where Paul Haggis comes in is, you know, the obvious, you know, liberal guilt that pervades this film. And one of the things I think is kind of amazing about this picture is that America is the bad guy. You know, there are any number of films where there are evil American agents that, you know, eventually it turns out, the America's working undercover and it's really okay. And I kept, you know, when you find out that Felix Leiter's partner is this, you know, corrupt, you know, what have you, who's enabling this dictator and this, you know, basically a stealing of the country's water resources, you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop and it really never does. This is a British film and the Americans are bad guys. And I always thought that was kind of cool. Yes, there is a brief nod to the very end where, you know, Felix's partner gets fired and he gets a promotion, but that's only after Bond steps in and saves the day.
I do like Jeffrey Wright. He's solid.
Yes.
He's
terrific.
Where's Jeffrey Wright been lately? I haven't seen him in a while. He was, like, starring in everything for, like, a couple years there.
Well, he was in Source Code just last year.
Okay.
Not smoking a pipe.
Source Code. I can tell you about the Source Code. that's my 2 second Jeffrey Wright impression. You can only go in for 8 minutes at a time. Okay, we got a tall, lanky guy here with his super awkward glasses. Yeah, that's right, Elvis. That's right. I'm sorry. We've jumped. This movie moved so quickly. Did Mr. White get shot too? Is he dead?
No. We'll see him again at the opera house.
That's right. Okay.
Everybody meets up at the opera. Anyway. But it is kind of confusing because when you see him at wherever he's being interrogated, you see him knocked over and you think he's dead. And then magically he shows up again at the opera.
Well, no, they acknowledge that he's fled after Bond's death.
Fair enough. Yeah.
He was shot in the leg and just put through like a horrific car chase sequence and then knocked over in a chair and tied up. But he was able to escape that scene because no one else was looking after him.
Oh, he has quantum on speed dial. So
yeah, he has quantum on speed dial.
Blowgun, save me! Sorry, you were saying.
So we have quantum's like the new Spectre. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Not Spectre.
It's the new Spectre. Spectre 2.0.
Yes.
Inspector Gadget. We got I like the idea of bringing back some kind of overarching villain. I don't want Scott, I don't want you to tell me if that plays a factor or not in Skyfall, but I do like the idea of that being something.
Fair enough. But no, I like the idea that, you know, it's not a matter of this evil organization that's trying to take over the world. They basically already control the world. It's implied anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they've already won. So, you know, in this film, at least, basically have to fight, you know, they have to stop them and take them out of power. It's sort of, it's a She-Ra situation versus a He-Man situation. Where the earlier films, they, you know, Bond and the gang were He-Man trying to defeat, you know, Skeletor from taking over Castle Grayskull. While in this film, you know, with Quantum, you know, Hordak's already taken over Hysteria, whatever it's called, wherever She-Ra lives, and they have to sort of fight back. This is a different dynamic.
Well, and a lot of people have complained that the villain plot of this is kind of weak, but I don't think people are seeing it, that it's just merely one little piece of massive, numerous plans that they have going on.
Well, I mean, and to be fair, you know, this guy takes the water from them and, you know, sells it at a premium. Thousands of people are going to die.
Yeah.
It's not like the guy's going to say, ha-ha, you have to pay 10 cents more for water. Gee, that stinks. You know, it's going to cause the dehydration death of thousands of people.
But, that plan is ultimately just one little sector of their plan. It's not the end game for Quantum, and I think people saw it as that.
Yeah. No, it was just one. It was one of their operatives and what he had planned on Tuesday.
Yes.
We're going to get to another action sequence here again. So before that, I just want to say that we skipped completely over like the whole Bond theme for this movie. And I feel we should do this a service to this movie by addressing the theme of the film, which was performed by Jack White and Alicia Keys. Brandon, are you a fan of that theme song?
No.
No. Scott? No. Yeah, no. I'm not a big fan of it. I like the concept of it. It's like, all right, do a duet and make it kind of hard rocky, but yeah, it doesn't.
I don't like them like squawking at each other during the choruses.
Yeah,
like I can be louder than you. I think it should have been just Jack White with doing the instrumentals with Alicia Keys singing. That would have been so much better.
Yeah, I agree.
So anyway, getting back to the action at hand. When this scene came out, I remember being happy just because the movie finally slowed down and we were like, all right, now we got villain stuff going on, so at least I can get into the plot more or not. And then this scene like happens and it felt like, oh, here we go again. Bond's kicking it into gear. Like, it's just relentless. I haven't seen Bond act like James Bond so far in this movie. I think that's my issue. I haven't seen like a cool Daniel Craig. I've just seen really determined Daniel Craig who's constantly, he just seems really angry the whole time.
Well, he is right.
He is angry, but it's still, I want to see a Bond movie. Like, I'm not having much fun. I'm just having, like, scowling Daniel Craig just going after whatever he's going after, and it's just...
Now, of course, you know, this is a classic, you know, idiot plot example. If he had just let her shoot the guy, the movie would be over.
Yeah, really?
Yes. So, darn. And again, you know, maybe it was sort of a commentary on how, you know, Bond wasn't always able to detect which damsels were actually in distress.
Well, he's not thinking straight. He's, you know, that's what M's trying to show him through the film.
Which is a fair reason you could argue as to why she's berating him constantly, because she needs her agent to be under control.
Yes.
And just because you have a license to kill doesn't mean you have to use it.
Doesn't make it less irritating.
This, along with there's a plane crash coming up in about probably 45 minutes, give or take, are one of the two genuinely... Yes, I would argue useless action sequences.
Yeah.
You know, as short as this film is, I would have rather seen more plot and character instead of this boat chase and the plane crash that shows up, comes out later. Other than that, even the fight in the apartment, it takes like 10 seconds, so it's not really that big of a deal. You know, he stabs him in the neck in about, you know, 30 seconds after they start fighting. So far, we've had a car chase, a foot chase, and a boat chase.
I mean, there's certainly variety. Yes. I can't argue that. There's a lot of different kinds of action going on in this movie, which is admirable.
Wait, there's something he does to one of the last boats that I'm kind of like, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a question I ask myself a lot.
Yeah. There's...
I have no idea
what he's doing.
Like, what just happened?
And no, this right here. Yeah. He takes the anchor.
Let's detail it out. He puts the thing on, and then for some reason.
Yes,
for some reason, the boat completely flipped like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll go with it.
The fast act is an active anchor, I guess.
I was just wondering if someone could explain it, but I'm okay with it. No, I'm
clueless as to what happened just then.
Well, that's okay. For a year, you know, every time I watch Living Daylights, I don't know how his partner is killed. Until someone actually, I think I looked it up on, like, you know, Google or Wikipedia, that, oh, it was an incredibly graphic scene that they actually couldn't show. I understand now. It's like, wait a minute, the glass breaks. He's dead? I'm confused.
Hey, who's that unconscious girl? Well, you know. She's seasick. Come on.
It's a Bond-like line.
Said with such vigor. I can get into Bond a little more. Daniel Craig, I like him. I like Daniel Craig as James Bond. At the same time, even in Casino Royale, there's something that bugs me about just the way Bond is presented. And it's less that it has to do with Daniel Craig's ability and, like, how they've structured him. It's more of, these are the movies about how James Bond became James Bond, which is obviously the intent. And coming off of, what, 20 other movies, I like having my Bond, who's already established as this cool guy that knows how to get around and, you know, is completely suave and gets women and goes through his action without much care, especially in the Roger Moore days. And it does kind of bug me that, I mean, we don't have all those Bond pieces here yet.
Yeah, I do like this movie. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But at the end of Casino Royale, I felt that, you know, it was set. Bond was there. We're ready to go. I mean, I wasn't like, oh, he's still got this to do and this to do. I felt, you know, this, you know, my Bond is here.
You're right. I agree with
there,
you.
There really, I mean, wasn't any, it wasn't necessary to keep going on that. It was already stated, and this is, you know, excess. I don't mind it, but it really, I mean, truly is. It was taken care of in the last film.
It feels like a regression of character.
This is the idea, like a half step back.
Yes. The idea that, you know, perhaps the death of Vesper sort of, you know, caused him to regress. But the problem is the very last scene of Casino Royale, you know, in its iconic final moment where he shoots Mr. White in the leg and delivers the line, you know, you're supposed to think, okay, now Bond is solidified.
I agree with that. Yeah.
And this, then we come to this movie, you know, 2 years later, and oh, no, he's still, quote unquote, in training, for lack of a better word. He's still finding his bearings.
And he also had the line straight from the book and stuff like, you know, it's done, the bitch is dead. It doesn't lead me to believe he's going to go on a revenge rampage.
Yes.
But he does, he learns that she was under different circumstances in this film, right? Or at the
end. Yes,
correct, yes.
So.
Retconning
and going forth, but
it, to a certain extent, it's almost similar to The Matrix and The Matrix Reloaded. Keep in mind, I like both Matrix sequels quite a bit, but I'm not gonna, you know, but at the end of The Matrix, you're basically, okay, he is the one, he can basically manipulate the world, he's gonna hang up that phone and poof, he's gonna destroy The Matrix and free everybody. Because he has that ultimate power. And then you get to The Matrix Reloaded, it's like, oh no, now he's just sort of like a monk that can fly and fight pretty well.
What I like, and I don't want to get too much into Matrix, but what I like about Matrix Reloaded is that he's less of a god and more of a, he's the heavy that Morpheus brings with him to handle action sequences.
Yes.
And I always kind of, like, when I watch Matrix now and it gets to the end, I always think, well, what if that scene takes place, like, after the events of Real Revolutions even? Like that final epilogue tag. Like
because
it doesn't make much sense to me about what you're saying with how Reloaded starts and where the Matrix ends. So I kind of fracture that out. That's kind of how I approach it now. Because obviously it's like, it's more of the Wachowskis didn't, you know, realize that they're going to make two more movies at that point. So,
yeah.
But that's how I kind of think, I picture it at this point. I'm just like, I don't even think about that scene. I just kind of like, it ends, and then he's reloaded, and Revolutions happens, and then you get that phone call from Neo, and he flies away. Like, that just makes sense to me. Anyway, let's get, we got Jeffrey Wright on, and he's cool. I like, he's a solid Felix. He's my favorite Felix. I mean, it's Jeffrey Wright. And this actor, David Harbour, who I've seen in a lot of things lately, he's a lot heavier here than he than I've seen him recently. He was in End of Watch, his most recent thing I've seen him in. But, and he doesn't have a mustache.
And this was the subplot that I was referring to earlier. You know, again, you're sort of expecting to hear that, oh, you know, the American agents are only pretending to be corrupt, but they're really undercover to get Peter Green or whatever this guy's name is. Like, oh, nope, nope, they're actually pretty much corrupt. which, again, I thought that was certainly very different from most Hollywood blockbusters, even a British one, arguably. And I like the politics of this film. Even if it is, yeah, there's a little bit of, you know, liberal fantasy thrown in there. The idea that only James Bond can save the oppressed people from the evil water thieves. I think we're coming up to the opera, aren't we?
Yes.
Yep.
The one genuinely great scene in this film, I would argue.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I feel like this is... if like Mark Forster had like ideas for this film, this is one of the scenes where he's like, I got this. Like, Mark Forster, strange choice for directing, by the way. What did he do to prove himself as a capable Bond director?
Daniel Craig liked him.
Okay.
Really? Fair enough.
They gave Bond his binder of directors.
it's not that he was the final choice, but he was kind of one that Craig mentioned he liked. And then with Forster, he brought on the Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Ultimatum second unit directors.
That's
not surprising at all.
Surprise!
Was Daniel Craig in a Mark Forster movie beforehand?
I don't know.
Like, he was in a Sam Mendes movie beforehand.
Yeah. Way beforehand.
Road to Perdition. But,
But...
Which if... Jude Law proved himself, he could have been a pretty cool Bond villain, just saying. Just if I look at Road to Perdition.
Hey, he still can.
He still can. Yeah, that's true. There's nothing stopping him.
I liked Finding Neverland. I thought it was okay. I thought Monsters Ball was fine. I love Stranger Than Fiction. I think it's a terrific film.
Yes.
But I think what they were thinking was we hire a director for the character and plot stuff, and then just let the second unit worry about the action. And I think from what I've gathered, and if I'm wrong, if someone correct me in the comments, that's sort of how Mr. Forster approached it as well. He sort of said, okay, I've got the Bourne team. They can take care of a lot of the action stuff. I'll just, you know, whatever ideas they throw my way, I will agree to them because I know what they're doing. And I guess that's part of why I like this film is I like the character work. I like the plot.
Yeah.
I don't like the action necessarily, but that's one part of the film. For example, on the other hand, Die Another Day, which is one of my least favorite Bond films, has terrific action in it.
Yeah, it does.
Amazing, amazing action sequences. But it's because everything else is faltering, I would argue it's a terrible film.
Give or take the heavy use of surfing in that movie. But yeah, it has great action in that movie. Oh my God, watching that recently too. Jesus. <That's a movie>. My God. Halle Berry is terrible in that movie.
Exactly. Yes.
Like,
yes.
It's like, I don't even know what she was doing in that. Like, she's an Academy Award winning actress. It's so
ironically
wrong. Mark Forster movie.
to be fair, she did receive the award while filming Die Another Day. Okay. It wasn't like I have my Oscar, what's my next project? Yeah. She was already on Die Another Day.
Back to
she's still terrible.
Yeah, she is. Back to Mark Forster. Rosamund is pretty good.
Okay.
But back to Mark Forster. He always I've liked some of his movies, I've disliked others of his movies. He seems to be like a Danny Boyle light, where they both kind of hop around between different genres, which is admirable. That's something I like when directors do, when they, you know, I can't pin people down necessarily because they've got to see so many different things. Stephen Frears is another good example of that, I think. But in terms of English directors that go around places. But yeah, that's great. He has a great team that he can work with about the action, but I feel like it doesn't have it. It's lacking. If there's so much going on in this lean movie in terms of you have this character stuff, and then you have this wild action stuff, and then you have these exotic location shots, and then you have these things that are supposed to make up the Bond aspect of the movie, it doesn't feel like there's necessarily a personality in this movie of one singular vision, as opposed to there's a lot of different things all coming together, and it doesn't mesh quite right to me.
No, I would agree with you. This doesn't feel like a Mark Forster picture per se.
Yeah.
While I would argue that, you know, Casino Royale, for example, feels very much like a Martin Campbell picture.
It feels both like a Martin Campbell picture and a Bond picture, even though it's an all new kind of Bond picture, given that it's the origin tale of Bond to an extent.
Forster did. I mean, he approached this with, you know, trying to cut to the chase. I mean, he wanted to. He saw a lot of scenes in different Bond movies as just dicking around and not getting to the point, and he wanted to. You know, he was allowed to make a, you know, 2.5 hour movie, but he said, no, we're going to make something short and impactful.
And like, I don't need a 2.5 hour Bond movie, but, and I don't even mind the fact that this movie is short. It's just, it doesn't feel like a Bond movie to me. And I get, yeah, it's nice to shake up the franchise, but I've seen shakeups in the franchise. We've talked about License to Kill already, which is one of the longer Bond movies, actually. But this flavor of Bond doesn't click right with me.
Now, I remember when I first saw this film, I was wondering, you know, is this a bunch of, you know, bloodthirsty, super rich people that are paying to watch these people actually be executed?
That'd be hilarious.
Well, because the film had been so dark up to that point that I'm thinking, you know, it's so about, oh, you know, the rich and their abuse of power and they, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, are they actually paying to watch like a stage stuff play or something? But
I found the scene generally creepy too.
It is, and that's part of what you know. It is creepy.
It's like it's the cousin to the scene where like Illuminati take over, or an Interview with a Vampire when all the vampires take that one girl down on stage. Like, it's just this weird scene. Yeah. Like, what's happening?
Right now? Yeah. It kind of makes you uncomfortable for Bond in the situation, which is really weird.
Crazy eyes.
And I'm always for action sequences set to, you know, atypical music.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the juxtaposition here. Like, this is the action scene that I'm like, I'm good with this one. This one's really cool. It's very stylish.
And they don't seem to care about innocent bystanders here, because they're rich. They can do that.
Even the editing, I think it's, because of the way they're utilizing music and just kind of the energy of this action sequence, I don't mind the editing here.
Yeah, I wish it was a little slowed down.
I agree with that. I mean,
Because I like this sequence a lot in theory, this is one of the sequences where the editing does bother me, because I wish I could have a better, clear geographical sense of what's going on. Who's being shot? Who's not being shot? You know, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we saw Crazy Eyes bring out his gaggle of henchmen. So.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, those guys are probably done. Okay, so here's this scene. So, Bond drops this guy, right? Or no, does he kill? Does he just drop himself?
Well, he sort of doesn't really make an effort to save him.
Yeah, there you go.
Which, yeah, but again, he's alive, as you're going to see in 2 seconds, and Peter Green, or one of his henchmen, kills him. And, you know, at no point does anyone, you know, does he ever say, hey, I didn't kill him.
I think that was the French equivalent of Gary Cole. Lumber.
Yeah.
So yeah, now we get to this M scene, and it does bug me that like we've seen M just be mad at Bond, and now he's gonna get this completely like Bond's framed. And yeah, I get that Bond just doesn't kind of care, but it's like you could say something to defend yourself in this situation.
Well, there's a lot of movies where characters are framed for a crime and they never come out and say, hey, I didn't do it. That's one of the things I liked about, you know, Fast Five, oddly enough, is there's a scene about a third of the way through where, you know, what's his name? Vin Diesel and Paul Walker basically confront The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, for the sole purpose of saying, hey, we didn't kill those people. You know, I know you don't believe me, but we didn't kill those people. And again, he doesn't say, no, I did not shoot him point blank and throw him off a roof. I just threw him off a roof.
See, now, okay, so Bond's, like, puzzled by this, but none of the words are...
And it's not going to make any difference at this point, though. Whether M believes him or not, there's evidence to the Prime Minister that he was shot, possibly by Bond.
So, okay, Casino Royale an issue I had is that the word ego, I think, is said way too many times in that movie.
I
think it's like, oh my god, I get it. Bond's, yeah, he's got an ego. And like, but Eva Green's just like, oh, your ego is making, you're going to lose this game. Your ego, your ego. This movie is just like, Bond, stop, Bond, stop, Bond, stop. It has that kind of thing. I don't know if that's a Paul Haggis touch of making sure the theme resonates.
Here we go. We got a Bond moment for you here.
Yep.
There you go.
Well, that's one of the things that sometimes annoys me about certain Christopher Nolan films. Arguably the Batman pictures, is that they basically pick one word and use it like it's a new vocabulary word.
Things are worse than ever.
It was like chaos, chaos, fear, afraid, chaos, fear, afraid. and I don't know if you guys have been watching Homeland.
I have been watching the second season.
You have not, or have?
I have not been watching the second season.
Well, this isn't a spoiler or anything, but if you take a drink for every time someone utters the phrase "Attack on America,"
well, yeah,
you will die.
That sounds like all of 24, but
I
like that Giancarlo Mathis' character. I like that he came back.
Continuity, yay!
Especially because it's pretty cold what happens in the end of Casino Royale. Which I guess, so that means, was Mathis innocent in Casino Royale?
Yes, he was. Yes,
it was just Matt Nicholson lying about saying your friend Mathis was my friend Mathis.
It was the setup.
But then even Bond's like, it just proves that she was also with him, not that Mathis is innocent. It's just like, damn, Bond's cold in that movie. Yeah. So it's like, good thing they come back here.
I like, this is one of the few moments where he, has a full-length conversation with somebody, frankly. Yeah,
he lets his guard down.
It's a character moment. And, I would argue in the latter half of the film, because we are halfway through this film right now, it's a little more character-driven than the first half, which is just, boom, 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 boom.
If I want to focus on this actor again, Giancarlo Gianni, he dies horribly in Hannibal. Just pointing that out.
Yes. But he is so good in Hannibal. The second act is superb. And every time I watch Hannibal...
He's the main character of the entire story.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah.
Every time I watch Hannibal, I get to the second act and I'm thinking, well, maybe this movie isn't as bad as I remember. And then we get to the third act and like, oh, right.
Here's where the rails came off.
Yes.
I mean, each story needed to be Hannibal Lecter in a different adversary in a different way.
Yeah.
And his character was, prime for being the Jodie Foster or the William Peterson character to his Lecter. And they play with it, but...
Well, I mean, without getting too much about Hannibal, the book was... I'm not saying it's a good book. It really wasn't. No. But it was a very satirical... extended middle finger to those who thought that Hannibal Lecter was some kind of pop culture hero after Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, it felt like fan fiction.
Which, something the movie didn't get at all, which is why it's so bad, because you're doing a story that's basically a spoof and playing it as some epic story of good and evil.
With gritty Ridley Scott direction.
Exactly.
It's really gritty, that movie.
That might be, like, one of his worst directed movies.
It's like,
from a director standpoint.
Yeah, especially for Ridley Scott. And it's like, I like Tony Scott, but it feels like Tony, like, was, like, giving him some advice on how to make that movie. I don't know what was going on in Hannibal.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But anyway.
Yeah, let's get back to Bond here. That whole sequence that we pass by, by the way, I liked it not be only because it's, a good character scene, as Scott said, but also it's in an exotic location that looks good. It's a good looking movie.
This movie, they apparently had the potential to look as beautiful as Casino Royale. They just, editing, just...
What's the budget on this movie? Do you know offhand? Is it
200 million.
200?
Yes. Casino Royale cost 150, and oddly enough, Skyfall cost 150 as well. So it was actually cheaper than this one.
This one does not look as that it cost even as much as those two. Even I haven't seen Skyfall, but from the trailers, you can see money was spent here.
Yeah. Without going into details, I was very surprised to hear that Skyfall cost less than Quantum of Solace.
Well, even just by those trailers, it looks like all the money's on screen.
Yes.
This movie, you're telling me it's $200 million. I don't know if I can see all that money on the screen.
Well, there's a lot of practical... Their movie is almost nonstop action, and most of it's real. So that, it's cut to pieces, so we can't necessarily appreciate it, but... Yeah, I'm sure that's where most of the money went.
Yeah.
It's just on staging the various action sequences.
Like Casino Royale. God, titles card. To Casino Royale, that movie looks like everything was spent in that movie. Like,
yes.
And that came, my biggest example of that is, 2005? Is that when Superman Returns and Dead Man's Chest both came out? That's 2006.
Right? 2006.
Yeah. Those two movies came out within, weeks of each other, and Superman Returns... It's within a week, yeah. Superman Returns came out, and that movie is just green and weird and doesn't look like it costs as much as it did, except for, I guess CG stuff. It just doesn't look appealing to me, that movie. It's hard to watch it just because of the cinematography so dark and stark for a movie about Superman who's, blue and red. The primary colors. The Dead Man's Chest comes out a week later. That movie looks like every cent was put on the screen in that movie.
Yes.
Like everything. That movie looks fantastic.
They both cost about the same, give or take, yet one... clearly looks like the money was on the screen, while the other one was shot in a god-awful, ugly, new cinematic... What was it, the Genesis?
I think so, yeah. It was Bryan Singer.
And, I remember, I did see it in the theater once, in IMAX, to be fair, so it was blown up a little bit.
With the 3D?
Yeah.
The select 3D scenes?
Yep. Take off your glasses, put them down. Take off your glasses, put them down. God, those were the days.
Yeah, what a time to be alive.
Yeah. We went to that together, didn't we, Scott?
We did. We did. Yeah. I was back when you lived in California.
Boom.
Yeah.
It was a 10:30 advanced night screening, and I left my – I think I was doing voiceover classes just for fun, basically, back then. And I left one early so we could all meet to go to the movie.
Is Strawberry Fields naked under that?
Probably.
Dressed like a flasher.
But – Yeah, this I would argue this film costs as much as it does just because of the sheer amount of action, whether or not we like the action or not. There's a ton of it there.
That's, yeah. Casino Royale just looks so amazing throughout. Like it's just the wide shot nature of it. That's what gets me.
Yeah, it's the wide shot nature, and also there's really only three major action sequences in the entire picture. I don't see that as a criticism, certainly, but. The rest of it is basically plot and character with the occasional brief skirmish.
Even the brief skirmish.
They have money.
Like that stairwell fight? That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Again, that's like a 30-second sequence.
But it's so intense.
Oh, it's great. It's great.
Honestly, she is just not wearing anything under that trench coat.
No, she really isn't.
It just does not look M just gave him a sex toy just to calm him down. Like that was her plan, I guess. I feel like he's channeling Connery in this scene, by the way. Every time I watch this.
Trying.
I feel like he's this seems like the clearest of him trying to be like Connery.
Instead he comes off like Timothy Dalton.
Yes.
I hate sex.
Done.
Oh.
What's up, Mathis?
I hope he's wearing pants.
No, who cares? Sam Mendes, who did Skyfall, he has a similar kind of pedigree of making different kinds of movies.
Yeah. He hasn't made that many, to my recollection.
Yeah. You go from Revolutionary Road to Away We Go, which was always confusing because the movie came out so quickly after that movie and because it's just drastically different from that other movie.
I actually enjoyed that quite a bit. I'm actually not a huge Sam Mendes fan overall. I was not a big fan of American Beauty. I was not a big fan of Road to Perdition.
I enjoy American Beauty quite a bit. Road to Perdition is a movie that I don't think Tom Hanks is necessarily amazing in that movie, but I respond to the father-son relationships in that movie between the three of them, between Paul Newman and him and Tom Hanks and his son. And Jude Law is fantastically creepy in that movie.
Yes, he is. I guess we can spoil Road to Perdition here. My problem with it is ironically the same problem I had with American Beauty, which is that he sets up a moral dilemma and then lets the hero die in a vaguely noble fashion rather than taking responsibility for his actions and living to fix his own mess.
It's the son. He doesn't want to be a killer. Jarhead bores me. I'm sorry.
I don't think I've ever seen Jarhead, actually.
I wanted it to be good. I really did, but it just bores me when I watch that movie. Jake Gyllenhaal is really solid. But
remember when that opened to $32 million?
Right.
Or 28, whatever
it was.
That was
when Jamie Foxx was on Top of the World, too. He hasn't really fallen. He just hasn't done much since then.
No. He's I'm sure Django Unchained will be just fine.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see.
Revolutionary Road's like the most uncomfortable episode of Mad Men I've ever watched.
It's Mad Men with Pete Campbell as the hero.
Yes, there you go.
Yes, very much so.
Getting back to this Bond movie.
What? Oh, right, a Bond film.
We do have Strawberry Fields here.
Green just gave his Evita speech.
and Camille's back as well. All the characters are in one location, actually. Felix, I guess everybody's here.
Felix is here with no interaction.
Is this the second of three Bond films in a row? Second out of two of the last three Bond films where you had the villain pretending to be a social do-gooder, pretending to try to save the world while actually being a villain in disguise? Because they pulled the same shtick in Die Another Day, right?
Die Another Day, yes, yeah.
He was, but Colonel Moon had taken the place of him.
Well, yeah, but I mean Colonel Moon had taken the place of him?
Gustav Graves.
Was Gustav Graves a person?
He was a person. He took his identity.
Oh, I didn't know he was actually a person. I don't remember that. I thought he made up an identity.
I always forgot that part, yeah. Mainly because I don't care.
Well, they bend so far over backwards to absurdity so they don't have to have a Korean villain.
Yeah, I don't know if the character was in the public eye.
Yeah.
Beforehand. It seemed like he was because he's like a billionaire or whatever.
Well, it was a really quick rags to riches story.
Yeah, because of his fencing talents with Madonna.
Yeah,
Madonna's in that movie, guys. That movie.
she also sings a song. You got the wrong era Madonna to do the Bond song.
Die Another Day. Oh my god, that movie has that insane sword fight that goes all over wherever the hell they're sword fighting in. It's like, and the music, it's so over the top. It's so ridiculous.
This guy's not evil.
Coming after like such a strong, like I feel like the opening of that movie is fairly strong, and even like getting to Cuba or whatever, like all that.
Cuba, happens. Where it goes off the rails for me.
It goes off. I'm still with it. That point, but that sword fight where I'm like, Jesus, happening.
Well, I think about this film, we're talking about cutting the fat or what have you, is what you're missing is the scene where Bond interacts with people and pretends to be undercover for 10 seconds and meets the girl and pretends to be the friend of the bad guy, and that's either not there or it's just taken care of like right off the bat. In a way, it kind of reminds me of Moonraker, which also skips sort of to the third act right off the bat, so to speak.
Well, Tomorrow Never Dies does that too, to an extent.
That is true.
Yeah.
That is true. It's also a relatively short Bond film.
That is, yes. It's only
about 10, 15 minutes longer than this one.
Yeah, like GoldenEye was fairly, that's 130 minutes, like that's... Not like super long, but it's longer, and so yeah, Tomorrow Never Dies.
Blink, or else you'll miss his toupee. There you go.
I saw it. Tomorrow Never Dies. Yeah, there is. Oh, Felix is here. Okay.
Yeah,
everybody's at the party.
Remember, I don't watch this movie often because I think it sucks. But I mean, it. I don't watch the movie because I don't care to that much. But I forgot Felix is there.
This is the only third time I've seen it. I saw it once in theaters, once on when it came out on DVD, Blu-ray, and now I'm watching it again.
Yeah, I saw it. Actually, this is my third full time watching it.
I believe this is like my fourth or fifth. So it's one we all don't just pop in and watch all the time.
No. But I would say that with most Bond films. I mean, even ones that I really, really like World's Not Enough. I've only seen that a handful of times.
I mean,
but you have so many options to choose from. I mean, yes. You can go years without seeing a certain one and be like, oh, this is the one I'm going to watch because I haven't seen this in forever.
I mean, I watch movies all the time and have tons of things to do. So it's more of having a Bond movie come out every couple of years is a good excuse for me to get all my Bond movies in.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to how much I enjoy the Bond franchise, just because there's 22 movies here and I've watched maybe 17 of them in the past few weeks. So it's like, I clearly enjoy Bond movies. I'm happy to like get them out.
Oh.
Like, that's really sad for Mathis. But, I mean, I'm happy to watch these movies. And so like, this provides me a good excuse to do so. The, getting into Bond movies in general, like when I was younger, I mean, I guess I grew up with the Pierce Brosnan movies to say that, but even before that, I was into Bond movies because, you know, they played the Bond marathons on TV before I had like DVDs and I had my VHS copies of it. Or like if TBS is playing a Bond marathon when I'm younger and I don't have any other way to watch them, I'm going to be digging in and watching those Bond movies. Like I generally enjoy watching the franchise, even if it's playing View to a Kill on TV. I'm like, all right, whatever. Stick with this for a while. One of my earliest Bond memories, I think, is watching Roger Moore run over alligators in Live and Let Die.
I still enjoy that.
I love that. Bond style.
I've seen where that's ridiculed, and I'm like, well, it's fun.
Bond style. It's Bond to me. I mean, that's... Yeah. It's... Sure, it's campy, but that's... To me, that is what James Bond is. As much as I consider Connery to be my best Bond, like I watch Roger Moore movies, and I rank him higher than most people would rank him. I love Roger Moore movies because he feels like Sean Connery is Sean Connery. Like he does when I think Sean Connery, I think of Sean Connery. When I think of Roger Moore, I think of James Bond, and that he's the only person I would say that about. When I think of Timothy Dalton, I think of Timothy Dalton or Sinclair from Rocketeer. When I think of Daniel Craig, I think of Daniel Craig. When I think of Pierce Brosnan, he's still Pierce Brosnan to me. I've seen him in a diverse amount of roles where he doesn't feel like he's the emblematic James Bond. Roger Moore is James Bond. For a lot of people, he's James Bond. Not necessarily the best and not necessarily the person they prefer as Bond, but he was that Bond he has the most movies as Bond. Like he's James Bond. Like he's a character that he's a person that everyone's familiar with as James Bond, regardless of if they like all of his movies or not. And so I stick up for him because of that. He played it a certain way, and I dug it.
We just talked over what I would argue is a very good dramatic scene.
It is.
It's sad.
It's very saddening. That's why I wanted to talk over it. He was a generally good character, and like now he has.
You're trying to disguise the pluses of the film. Okay. The big airplane action sequence. I enjoy it, but you know I can agree that it's unnecessary, but I do enjoy it as it is. But it's something that was one of those held over action sequences that was dropped from other movies.
There's a really big indie fan, apparently.
What was it dropped from? Do you know?
It was just one that, you know, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if Bond did this? Yeah, we'll try to get it in this one. Nah, not gonna work. Not gonna work. And finally, here it is.
Feels like
I think it goes back to the 80s, actually.
It feels like it's just a mix of scenes that I've seen in Tomorrow Never Dies and License to Kill and Moonraker. Just like a hodgepodge. Isn't it just like Bond gets into a dogfight, jumps out of a plane, gets a parachute at the last second?
Yes.
I think I've basically seen that in three other Bond movies, just all in one now. It's like... Even GoldenEye has an awesome plane sequence.
That is indie.
Yeah, right? He's head of the indie fan club in the country that they're in.
I don't know. How old would Indiana Jones be in 2008? He wouldn't be around, would he? No, he was
actually in theaters in 2000.
Well, but did you know what I mean?
What a big year for movies, by the way.
Yeah.
It mimicked the summer of 89. It had Star Trek not moved. It would have been exactly like the summer of 89.
Well, Star Trek was supposed to open Christmas in 2008.
What's the Ghostbusters 2 equivalent?
0.2.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah,
that's a far better movie than Ghostbusters 2. But...
Oh my god, I love Hellboy 2. Hellboy 2 is the best movie that came out that had to suffer from Dark Knight.
Yes.
Okay.
No, it was... Yeah,
that's a movie where the money's on screen, by the way, too.
Yeah.
Hellboy 2, oh my god. There's
not a lot of it.
Yeah, it's insanely cheap, but like the special features on Hellboy 2, amazing how much craft went into some of that stuff.
why I it's a shame we haven't seen a film from Guillermo del Toro since.
Oh God, he hasn't made one anything since, has he? He's been so long not making The Hobbit.
Yeah.
The footage then, the footage for Pacific Rim is insane, just saying.
Oh, they showed it at Comic-Con?
Oh yeah, and it looks crazy good. I'm sad that he's being forced to make a 3D, but whatever. anyway, there's the whole plane stuff. That's an interesting point, though, about 80 summer of 89 being very emblematic of this summer, of this 2008 summer.
You get, you know, a James Bond second mission. You get Batman versus the Joker. You also had Indiana Jones.
Yep.
You almost had Star Trek with Kirk.
And of course, you had Prince Caspian. Like, look who's talking. Actually, they both made about $140 million, but Look Who's Talking did not cost $220 million to make.
When did that terrible Terminator movie come out? Was that
2009?
2009.
A year later. Okay.
Yes.
That's right. Because that was my biggest disappointment of that year.
Because
I was trying to remember. It's like I can't remember if
there were a lot of disappointments that summer.
What happened in 2009? What else came out?
Star Trek, Wolverine, Angels and Demons.
Both. I mean, is anyone disappointed by any of those?
Well, Wolverine was terrible.
But were you disappointed?
Fair enough.
But Wolverine, I think, is the best movie that the 80s never made. That's what I consider one. if Wolverine, even the level of CG in that movie, if Wolverine came out in 1987, people would love Wolverine. It's a perfect, Reagan era revenge movie.
Where the girlfriend dies just so he can go no.
I think there's four overhead screaming shots in Wolverine.
I was disappointed by Star Trek. It was not as good. I have issues with it.
I like hearing that just because I'm not a fan of that stuff. Well, I don't dislike that Star. Well, no, I don't. I'm not a Trekkie. I don't care for Star Trek at all. I'm incredibly indifferent to Star Trek as a series in general. Watching Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams one, I was like, I liked the first hour, and then all those convenient things happened at the same time where Kirk was thrown off a ship onto a planet where a vagina monster attacked him, Spock comes out of nowhere, saves him, and gives him all this exposition. All of that within,
And takes him to Scotty.
And Scotty's introduced. Yeah. All these
The third act is a mess because of that.
Eric Bana is good though. That's what I like. Yes. In that third act, he's good.
Well, I left that movie. I was like, that was good, but the sequel, it was a movie you could tell that the sequel was going to be so much better.
I hate Star Trek. I hate the.
I don't know if it is, but I felt that way. But knowing productions, with this one, it felt like when you leave Batman Begins, knowing he's going to go after the Joker, you know that movie's going to be solid.
I hate time travel in Star Trek. That's my other big issue. I feel like it's a cheat.
It's something they've been using for years and years and years.
It was. It was a way to have their cake and eat it too,
As a person that doesn't know Star Trek, I don't know how often they use time travel in the past in Star Trek series. But
I'm not a big Trekkie. I'm more of a fan of the film series of Star Trek.
Yes,
but I do know time travel has been a presence in Star Trek since the very beginning, and quite a big presence.
Okay, here's all this Bond stuff now. Back to Quantum of Solace. Yeah. Thank you, anybody that's listening to this commentary, by the way, bearing with us as we go on wild tangents. But all right. So now we have Bond free-falling with Camille. It seems incredibly fast. That's another thing about the scene. I don't mind the idea of Bond free-falling in the air, because, as Brandon has said before, Moonraker is his favorite Bond opening of all time, correct?
Yes.
But there's a velocity factor that I just feel is completely unbelievable.
Oh, they should be dead.
Like, the way they show them falling is just so fast, which I guess fits the theme of this movie, but it just defies any kind of logic at this point.
Get your heart racing.
As much as Bond has defied logic in the past, I mean, that's... in a movie that seems to be technically grounded in some sort of reality, it seems like that was pretty wild for them to fall from a plane like that and, live.
Yeah.
I thought it was fun.
Okay. What's the other thing? Oh, the game. The Quantum of Solace game I like more than this movie. The chief reason being the Quantum of Solace game is more focused on Casino Royale than Quantum of Solace.
That's interesting.
It's
probably got better editing, too.
It does. It's... The game literally, you play through the first couple levels and you get to that scene where you fall on the airplane, And then it just does like an entire flashback to almost all of Casino Royale. And it's like, all right. And it, because it's like using the Modern Warfare engine, because Infinity Ward made, or Activision made that game, like it feels like a Call of Duty game. And it's like, it actually plays pretty well. And it's not GoldenEye, but it's still fun. And it has all these great iconic scenes from Casino Royale. And I'm like, all right, I'm really into this. And then it gets back into Quantum of Solace story. And I'm like, just saying, throw the shout out to a video game movie transfer that, you know, worked for me well enough just because of how good the movie it was representing was.
Getting back to our tangent from a few minutes ago, Wolverine is a phenomenal video game.
It is.
I'm actually excited for The Wolverine, at least partially because of the video game spinoff.
Yes, Wolverine is an amazing video game. The X-Men Origins Wolverine game, that game is awesome. I love that game. It's God of War Wolverine. It's incredible. It's everything that you'd want in a Wolverine movie that you could never have, because it's insane. Yes. M-rated. You see everything that Wolverine's capable of in terms of the kind of gore that he can give off in that realm.
It's a very cinematic game, too.
Yeah, the story has a nice framing device.
Because we have another rarity of rares here, an actual character scene with dialogue and conversation.
Yep.
Where she explains...
I actually really like this scene.
Well, I like it because, you know, in most movies where you have a character avenging the death of their father, you know, the father's presented as a saint-like figure, and Mira's like, no, he was a monster, but, you know, he killed my dad, and I want to get the guy that killed him.
Bond girls with purpose.
Yes.
But you know, it's not as good as, you know, ones that sing underneath the mango tree.
I still prefer Ursula Andress over Olga Kurylenko.
I'll be the guy that is blasphemous and say I prefer her.
As do I. No, Andress never did anything for me.
This girl had her father killed and does something about it.
Yeah, okay. I will say I liked Olga Kurylenko in Centurion because she had her tongue cut out.
Centurion was awesome, because I won't go on about all right. that.
Well, it has so many awesome things. You have the Fassbender factor, which is automatically a win.
It also lived many childhood sword fighting fantasies of bloodshed off the bat. I was like, wow!
It's another...
I'm a big Neil Marshall fan, and he always...
I like the way he shoots action.
He makes his graphic violence count and feel like it hurts.
I'd be curious to see what his version of this movie would look like, actually.
Probably R-rated.
If you put him on a leash a little bit and make him make a PG-13 movie, I'd be curious to see how he make a Bond movie.
You know, a lot of these times with these PG-13 movies, when you could tell it used to be an R, some of the implied violence is far worse than if they would have just shown it.
Oh, yeah. There's a... What's the one that... actually, not even an action movie, but a horror movie. Drag Me to Hell. Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell is a perfect PG-13 movie, but the unrated cut of that movie, I don't like that version, even though it has more blood, because it looks really like it's really CG and bad and stuff, opposed to the PG-13, which implies a lot of the horror, which I really enjoy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that film, actually, one of the reasons it didn't do that well at the box office is because everybody assumed it had been horribly compromised for a PG-13. I saw that movie, frankly, really early. At a test screening, oddly enough. And it was, you know, basically the final cut for all intents and purposes. And no, it didn't need to be R. It was a very scary and, you know, not gory, but kind of gross and slimy PG-13
horror. Oh, yeah. It's a Raimi film. It's a Raimi horror film, and it feels like it, regardless of it being PG.
The Evil Dead's cousin.
It is.
Yeah.
This is the indie fan club, all those guys up there.
Okay.
They can't.
They just want water.
They're the Rango reenactment troupe.
Oh boy. Rango.
I like Rango.
I love Rango. Rango's one of my favorite movies of last year.
Yeah.
Chinatown with lizards? Come on.
Sign me up.
Let's do this.
I just can't wait till they do the two Jakes and Rango 2.
It'll wait 17 years.
The two Rattlesnake Jakes?
Yes.
Two Bill Nyes for one.
I have to say, while most of the cartoons have been pretty good, with the exception of Paranorman, which I think is pretty terrific, it's been a pretty year for animation so far.
I would agree.
I liked Wreck-It Ralph, but I didn't love it. I liked Madagascar. I didn't love it. You know, and I didn't like Brave at all.
I would agree because Paranorman's a movie that stands out to me while the other ones that I've seen this year, unless I'm not thinking of one, which I don't think I'm not.
I think all I've seen is Paranorman, animation-wise.
You got the best of them.
I'm happy. Sorry, I'll keep going to Paranorman. Paranorman's a movie I saw the trailer for a year ago, and I was like, I want to see this, and I'm happy that it delivered in spades for me.
Yes.
Unlike Prometheus for most of us.
All right, so they're all dirty and tired. That's nice.
It was used on the marketing for this movie. It's like, look, he's beat up.
Yeah, and he's got this chick with him. What's going on?
He's not wearing a tie.
Yeah. That's right, Grumpy Face is back, guys. Squints Magoo is back.
I really like this this scene here.
I actually do too. This is the scene I remember right now.
This is what you get Mark Forster for.
Yeah, it's played for horror, basically.
It honestly works better than I'm going to sound like an asshole, but I mean, in the context of everything, it works better than Goldfinger.
Of course it does. Because
Goldfinger is iconic. It's what it is, but in the story,
I can agree with you to an extent, but I think it's just a different time kind of thing.
Well, it's a different time.
You can place a lot more emotional emphasis on something like this now, as opposed to Goldfinger, where I don't think an audience didn't necessarily need to like linger on the idea of this girl dying. I mean, this is very
and she didn't really matter to anybody but her sister, who was really quickly offed in Goldfinger.
Yeah,
as well, which seemed. I mean, in watching it now, it seems kind of silly. Why did you bring in her sister if you're just going to offer a scene later?
It pumps up the villainous nature of Oddjob.
That poor family lost two daughters.
I'll argue for the different mindsets of the films and the times that they're in. That's the only
thing
I can put forward.
The times that they're in, but
because this is obviously very tragic, it is very sad that this person died this way. And given the rough and tumble nature of this movie versus Goldfinger, which is a movie that has that ability to kind of wink at itself. This movie doesn't, and so you're able to treat a scene like that with much more seriousness and a horrific kind of tinge. Also, Bond just beat up everybody in that elevator, and that was pretty cool.
Pretty cool. And I like what he does here when he sneaks around. Very Bond. So let's say in the second hour, or a second hour, as if there were two, the second half of the film, he's a lot more Bond than he was in the first.
I'll agree with that. M always looks fabulous, by the way, in every one of these movies he's in.
Oh, yeah.
Judi Dench knows how to look authoritative and classy.
I do like that her relationship with Craig is far different than Brosnan.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, like, he's almost her goon in these.
Yeah.
Their relationship just cracks me up in these two movies.
Connery got along well with M. Connery got along with Moneypenny. Roger Moore got along with M really well. Pierce Brosnan got to do a lot with Q, and those scenes are fantastic. I love Q scenes with Brosnan. And this one, Craig and M seem to have like the best relationship here.
I think it's they were almost more equals when it was Pierce Brosnan and Judi Dench.
Yeah, because they're both coming off of you're both supposed to. The Cold War just ended, and they're both in that same kind of mindset of like things are different now.
Yeah. And in these films, it's more of a, I don't want to say maternalistic because that's not quite what it is.
Yeah.
But she's sort of like, I want to craft this one from the start. So therefore, she has more of an interest in how he turns out.
It's not a Yoda or an Obi-Wan one either. So I'm trying to think of it's not a Miyagi one either because she's not really teaching him anything. She's just more of like.
It seems overly professional. Her relationship with
him. If you want to go, it's almost, you know, JD Dr. Cox from Scrubs.
There you go.
You know,
there you go.
He doesn't want, you know, she doesn't want to be his mentor, but she sees him enough to know that he's worth paying attention to.
That's the best example. I like that one.
There you go. Thank you. Perfect.
Cute spider here.
who was Lazenby's relationship with? Oh, the Bond girl.
The Bond girl.
Yes.
And then Dalton's.
Dalton doesn't have friends.
Dalton really have
Felix.
Yeah, I guess so. He's really torn up about Felix.
Two Felixes. He avenges one of them.
Although, it is really horrific when a shark kills you or it takes your limbs and your wife's dead. Like, it's. Yeah.
But
that whole opening scene of License to Kill is devoted to Felix and Bond having a grand old adventure as they arrest Robert Davi in an airplane heist that's similar to Dark Knight Rises.
Yes. What if I took Moonraker and mixed it with License to Kill? Or I shot License to Kill like Moonraker was.
What can I tell you, Bond? There's no such thing as a free lunch. You don't know me. I'm just going to read all of Felix's lines because I love Jeremy Bright.
It's not much time at all, is it?
I could watch Jeffrey Wright play Lando Calrissian in the Disney remake of Star Wars.
That's actually,
no good at double-crossing. What are you doing here?
Do you get the sense from Jeffrey Wright in this movie that he kind of didn't want to be here?
I feel like they flew him in and he did his lines.
Yeah. He doesn't have much to do.
Yeah.
But
his
character doesn't want to be there either.
Yeah, that's
true.
And that's a nice touch. He still just sits and drinks the beer.
I told him what I had to.
He drinks lighter beer.
Oh!
Ba-dum.
Shut up.
Connery says, "Hey," or was it Roger Moore in *Live and Let Die*? When it's like, "Oh, a genuine Felix lighter," when he's handed a lighter.
And now we're off to the relatively subdued action climax, which has the dumbest hotel ever. Yeah. Let's just fill this thing with like propane tanks or whatever it is.
I give this credit because it feels like a Bond hideout. That's
yeah, it does. It
feels like a Bond hideout. Sure.
And then they'd never done one in a desert. He wanted Forster wanted the Swiss Alps, like on Her Majesty's Secret Service, but production cost, you know.
Is there skiing in Skyfall, Scott? Is there pond skiing?
No.
Damn it. Okay.
We got two more chances.
Gotta wait for Craig 4.
I was trying. I'm not sure if I was supposed to say that I had seen the new one yet. I was trying to avoid that in some of my comments.
Not like anyone's going to live question it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Let alone
I just don't want what I know about the next film to influence my discussion of this one.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Yeah. That's why I purposely not tried to address Skyfall. But I have been curious about these.
The part, you know, when there's half of the film where James Bond is killed is kind of shocking. But...
When Q becomes the real hero of Buzz.
Yes, exactly. Ben Warshaw takes up the...
And then he ends up shooting himself in a bathtub at the end of the movie, right?
And then he murders a bunch of redheads.
Oh, perfume. Do you like perfume, Scott? Are you a fan of perfume?
I do. It's
Should I say, are you a perfumer?
Perfume, a story of murder.
I have a fun story with perfume. I was not a fan of it, but... Scott and I went to see it, and there was another line, because we saw it, we were supposed to see it with Tom Tickver, Q&A afterwards, and we get in there and he didn't show up, but meanwhile, there was another line with a Q&A that they were offering us that we could go in that line if we wanted instead, and it was for Pan's Labyrinth with Guillermo del Toro, which
because 2 years later, we saw Guillermo del Toro in Hellboy.
Yeah, we did see him with Hellboy too, so that made up for that. But you know, no Tom Tickver. That was slightly disappointing.
Dustin Hoffman in that movie is something.
It's interesting. I mean, last thing I'll say about Perfume is that Alan Rickman plays a character that the entire time reminded me of of Turpin from what's it called? Sweeney Todd. And then he goes off and plays the same character in Sweeney Todd.
Yes. Is that the same year?
No, 2 years later. About a year and a half later.
A year and a half later, yeah, okay.
Give or take. No, about a year later.
Because Sweeney Todd was like 2000. Yeah.
2006.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah.
And Sweeney Todd was Christmas 2007.
Yeah. Perfect Christmas movie.
Yes.
My mom and I saw it Christmas Day.
We saw it sometime that weekend because my wife and I got married that week and we were in Disney World for our honeymoon.
Ooh.
Actually, we got there so early that our hotel was not open. So in desperation to find something to do because nothing else was open, we saw National Treasure 2 at like 8 in the morning.
National Treasure 2 still treasuring?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's a movie.
Yes, it was a movie.
Yeah. Yes. Helen Mirren and John Voight swing on vines in that movie.
Yes, they do.
Only matched by Shia LaBeouf. Let's get back to Bond. We're in the whole, you know, the Bond villains interacting with the evil general part of the story. Classic part of that. Actually, I think this happens a lot in Bond movies, right?
The evil rapey general
and the Bond villains.
Just make sure you want to make sure you actually want to see him killed. He gets a raping right before he's killed.
Yeah. You know what they say, you get busy raping or get busy dying, right?
Well, he did both.
Yeah.
And I love that there's nobody else in this hotel other than those, you know, handful of people.
It hasn't opened yet, right?
That's true.
Yeah, I think it's like.
They're wondering how they're going to attract people to stay in the middle of the desert.
you get to parachute in.
Yeah.
And there's no smoking in this hotel.
We have live entertainment from Jack White and Alicia Keys every night.
Action is done.
Landed.
That poor general being forced to sign the contract he didn't want to sign.
You know, we haven't mentioned this at all. This is a writer's strike movie, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Daniel Craig and Mark Forster came up with fixes and improvisations and
some would
different
say
directions.
It shows, but
it does.
No, it does.
And that's now their official excuse for why the film didn't work out as well as they thought. Because, you know, that's what you do now. When you go make one movie, you basically concede guilt on the one you made previously rather than defend. But that's
I think I don't like that approach to sell the next movie. You got to bash the previous
right?
one.
That's I always had problems with Ocean's 13 because of that. Because I liked Ocean's 12 a lot more than most people
did.
Yes,
may have thought it was a bad movie, but did you really? I mean, there's movies where you know it's bad, but then there's this, you know, disingenuous thought that, you know, Daniel Craig is like, yeah, Quantum of Solace wasn't it great? No, I'm pretty sure he probably thought this was gonna be better received than it was.
Well, and of course, the classic example is, you know, how Disney spent the entire marketing campaign of Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides trashing the original, the first two sequels.
Yeah, really?
And then delivered in a godly awful film. Speaking of films that don't look like they cost $250 million, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh, wow, yeah.
Tides, oh, that's a bad movie.
That final action sequence looks like it just screamed that it was on a set.
There's action in that movie?
I fell asleep.
Our final series of events.
I was in that movie in IMAX 3D. I fell asleep in a little bit of it.
Oh.
That hurt.
No, it's shameful. At some point, people will realize that Rob Marshall is a bad director, but not yet.
Does this movie have Heineken in it?
I don't know. I don't know beers.
Casino Royale had it. But I don't think this one did.
I'm trying to remember if I remember.
Why are there hydrogen tanks all over this hotel?
Yeah.
I'm sure the video game level of this is awesome, but...
It's kind of annoying, actually, because you know, fire is never fun in video games. But I'm trying to think, because I know Skyfall, I've heard plenty that Heineken's no vodka in the Skyfall because it's Heineken. But I'm trying to remember if I remember hearing something similar about Quantum of Solace, too. Like, okay, now we're getting to the... Yeah!
Yeah. Now this guy just goes apeshit, and I don't buy it. It's one of the weak points of the film.
There it is. There's the yelling. Oh my God.
It's self defense. He knows if he stops, he dies.
He seems more like a weasel that would try to sneak out than going to go after Bond.
This is that kind of thing, too, where it's like Bond's been kicking ass throughout this entire movie, and now, like, this, what, 4'2" guy chums up and acts and, like, suddenly Matt Bond is no match for him.
See, this fight, you know, is what it is, but the other one's what has the good payoff. The Camille versus General.
Well, that one, you know, it matters more.
It's an emotional fight.
And I like that they don't chicken out. They actually let her kill him. They don't do the whole wah wah, vengeance won't solve anything.
And not just kill him, but like she stabs him quite a bit before he actually dies.
Yeah.
Like, come on, Bond. What are you swinging and missing at this guy? Only because he's too short, I have to imagine. But like,
well, it's like when you pick. Saw that one. What was it, Odd Job and Goldeneye?
Yeah. Goldfinger. Yeah.
No, I mean when you pick the game Goldeneye, when you pick
Odd. Oh, you pick Odd Job, which is a weird choice. It's like, hey, we have Neck Knack and we have God Job. Let's mix them together. Like, what's going on there? Which annoys me just because everyone now forgets that Odd Job is actually an physically imposing person because they think of the Goldeneye game.
Yes. Why is he not dropping him? Especially, you know, when, you know, he doesn't arrest him in the first place.
Why is he not dropping him? What does he have to gain this character? Does he need to know more about quantum? Like, is he going to talk? Is he going to talk right now? Why did he pick him up? Like, what was the reason for that?
You're right. This probably would be a pain in the video game.
Yeah, it's just because fire burns, and you can't. It's first person, so you can't. You have no perception about what's around you. Oh, I found you! Thank God. It's a big hotel. It'd probably take me a lot longer in a smoke-infested room like this, but I got you. Here you are. We should probably get out of here.
We are just going to burn the hell out of this place.
I was surprised that he died here. I was not expecting that.
Where does the title come from? Do you know offhand?
Quantum Solace? It's a short story title.
A short story title?
Yeah, it came from the For Your Eyes Only collection of short stories.
For Your Eyes Only was an anthology series?
He had a couple of short stories. The other one books. The other one was... two of them, actually. The other one was called Octopussy and the Living Daylights. Guess which movies got those titles?
Well, that was just lucky.
Oh, that's right. He picks him up so we can see him suffer in the desert later on.
Well, yeah, but I mean... what's the point?
I know, I'm not saying there's a point. I'm just saying now I remember what happens.
If he thought there was if he had a car and he thought maybe he could arrest him, I'd understand. That'd be one thing.
That
amount of time.
The book Quantum of Solace, Bond says that he explains that it's the amount of comfort when the other person in a relationship not only makes you feel insecure, but actually seems to want to destroy you. It's obviously the end. The Quantum of Solace stands at zero.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
This is like a trailer image too, right? Bond with this like wrecked jacket and all dirty stuff.
Yeah.
I remember enjoying that. Like I don't mind the idea of like...
Well, he does interrogate him.
Yeah. Okay, there you go. I don't mind the idea of Bond being dirtied up. I just wish he'd, you know, stop scowling so much. I mean, even Timothy Dalton in License to Kill, a movie that is quite graphic, and again, I think after watching Casino Royale and even this movie, I still think License to Kill is pretty gory of the Bond movies. I think it might be the goriest one, but I mean, that movie, it does have a share of humor as well. Like, as I said before, a giant fish winks at Bond at the end of that movie.
What a horrible way to die, by the way.
Yeah, stuck in the desert with a can of oil.
Jeez, that's vicious.
I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you.
Actually, Bruce, that's kind of the same, and yeah. Then why'd you save the Joker, you idiot?
Hey, Bond, what happened to Dominic Green out there? It's me, Figgle Slider. I'm calling you. Action number now. M, give it to me.
Felix, what can you tell me about the source code?
No one must know about the source code. You have to be in and out in 8 minutes.
You guys okay there?
Yeah. Oh, and here we are. Bond does not hook up with Bond girl. No.
No.
Sleeps with Strawberry Fields, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, four times. But, No, you don't see the scene where Bond, like, slips his number into her back pocket as she gets out of the car? You don't see that part?
Oh, I didn't see
it. You didn't see that part? It's blink if you miss it, just like the toupee. Is this still David Arnold doing the score for this movie, by the way?
I don't know.
It is. Yeah. Yes, it is. I got to see it now. Yeah, it is.
They got a new person for Skyfall, right?
Yeah, they got Thomas Newman, who's Sam Mendes' his boy. It's pretty quick, but he completely slipped his number in there.
Well, with Mark Forster's editing, they probably just had sex.
Yeah, sex in the car on the way over. That's what it is. They're driving. It's like, this is a long drive in the desert. Want to get on me right now? There's no other cars here because we're all, you know, on sand.
Thank you, title card.
Yeah, where are we?
There you go. Gotcha.
It's just, you know, fancy fonts and things opposed to, like, the standard. I mean, yeah, I get it. They're diversifying, but still, it's like.
They're informative and pretty.
Yeah. This does, if you want to look at this as one big film, which I guess many people do, and it's a way to accept it, it does kind of make it circular, too, in terms of Bond starts in a dark room with a gun at a desk.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
Except he doesn't, you know, brutally kill two people in the opening sequence, in the end sequence of this film, but instead spares the lives of two people.
Because he's learned.
Because he's learned, exactly. I like in Casino Royale, he's like, oh, that's learned. he's like, done. And then, like, things, even worse things happen to him at the end of that movie.
No, I like the end of this film. It's an unusually, you know, it's unusual to have a Bond film that basically ends on, you know, what's basically an emotional climax like this. You know, where it's not, you know, there is more after the, you know, villain's hideout blows up and the villain gets, you know, falls to his death or whatever. I mean, with the exception of arguably Under Her Majesty's Secret Service and I don't know, maybe Casino Royale.
I mean, I think it easily Under Majesty's Secret Service is what
Casino Royale has a brief, you know, declassifying moment with a little tag at the end.
Yeah.
Well, even Casino Royale more is like an extended kind of ending sequence, and then you realize, oh, nope, there is more action to come. Like, that movie's just, it's the epic Bond. Like,
yes. Well, with the exception of, it's about 3 minutes shorter than Skyfall. But of course, the longest is still just because of, you know, Imagine Secret Service, which back in those days with credits were, you know, 2 minutes long.
Yeah, but that movie does also have, if you made that movie now, there's a whole, like, middle of that movie that could be trimmed down considerably.
Oh, yes. yes.
Oh, he shot him.
Mark Forster.
See, this moment right here is where I just, you know, him and M, I found humorous. Just when she... Well,
it's a reaffirmation of their relationship.
Yeah, and it's also a reaffirmation of Bond is Bond now, just like we had at the end of Casino Royale. So now that, that little dalliance for the past hour and 45 minutes is gone.
Mm-mm. A very Bond Christmas.
Well, as we all know, Christmas only comes once a year.
Oh. Which I was given hell for her not making the top five of a worst list.
Welcome to Troll World.
She's just not. Yep. She's not in it enough for her.
I got attacked as if I put her in the best list.
Yeah. Well, that's how it is sometimes. I mean, it's. You know, it's, you know, a B plus is a pan, and, you know, it's.
Yeah. It was funny. I got a little snarky, but I backed up my argument.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the film, you know, a B plus is a pan, a C plus is a rave. Yeah. And this is the end of the film.
Yep. And. We get our gun barrel sequence.
James Bond will return.
In Skyfall.
Let's see how he shoots the shot here. Oh, yep, standard shot. No taking the knee, Lazenby style.
He shoots, you know.
Well, I will say this, Skyfall is better than this.
Okay.
Thank you. If that needs to be said. No, I still like this film. I understand, you know, I do understand most of your complaints. I can't entirely disagree with them. But for me, again, you know, there are so many James Bond films, some of which are, you know, do vary the formula a little bit, that I kind of like that one of them is a little bit is like this. And I like the, you know, obviously I think it's a decent film. You obviously do not, which, you know, it doesn't matter why it is what it is. If you don't like it, you don't like it.
Yeah.
I think while they're not, there's not a lot of them, and there's not very long, I do like a lot of the personal moments in this film and a lot of the personal scenes that we get. I think those are well-directed, well-acted, and they work for me. And some of the action sequences bring some intensity that I like that, you know, while they may not be elaborate, you know, well-thought-out action sequences, they can bring some intensity. I do like the car chase at the beginning. Some of the fights. There's some cool stuff. My thing is, I'm looking at some beautiful shots. I'd like them to linger on them some more.
I agree with that. Yeah.
But I enjoy this as just, you know, a nice little action film. I don't think it's the best. I don't think it's the worst. I feel it's kind of on the better side of the middle.
Yeah, and I put it, I've said this many, I don't hate this movie. I think it's watchable, and I would put it probably right smack in the middle. But it's just like, I mean, when Bond movies come out, the good, I mean, especially the good ones, but there are movies that kind of represent the best of, like, an adventure movie of that year when they come out. They're, Bond movies are an event. Like, people, I mean,
yes.
I've watched, Brandon, you've watched 22 movies in preparation for the next Bond movie. Like, it's, like, something significant that's coming along that only happens every couple of years. And Quantum of Solace, given when it came out and given what it's coming after and given the capabilities of these kind of movies nowadays, like, it didn't feel like the event of that year for me. I had other movies that year that were just fantastic. I mean, I had, that's 2008. I had my Dark Knight. There's a lot of good movies that year. I had my movies that fulfilled what I would expect from my Bond movie that year already, and this movie didn't match up to that, nor did it match up to the movie that preceded it, nor did it match up in my eyes to what I want in a Bond movie.
Fair enough. I mean, everybody has complete differences in what they want in a Bond movie. For someone like me, I'll say, you know, I enjoy Live and Let Die, where I'll see someone say it's one of the worst movies in the series. I don't see it, but I'm looking for different things in the Bond movies. When I was, you know, ranking these and going through them, a big part of it was I entertained? Was I, you know, how was I when I was watching this? And, you know, this one was high up there. I mean, I was entertained. It's not a long movie. I follow it well. I enjoyed myself. I didn't feel like I was doing a chore by checking it out. So a lot of mine came from, you know, when I was watching it now, my entertainment factor.
And, yeah, I mean, that is true. Like, everyone does have their favorite Bond movies, for sure.
I mean, we all oogled over Moonraker, but there's a good show of hands that are going to call us morons.
Yeah, but I also argue that people that say that about Moonraker either haven't seen Moonraker or haven't seen all the Bond movies, but
yeah.
It's, I mean, like, you guys are much less fans of Goldfinger than I am, and Goldfinger's my favorite Bond movie, while you guys, well, Scott, you kind of hate it, and Brandon, you rated pretty low, and Brandon, you rated Dr. No pretty low, if anything.
I did rate Dr. No pretty low.
And there's a lot of people that think Dr. No is just the pinnacle of a Bond movie, for reasons that are acceptable, but, I mean,
I can get away with ranking A View to a Kill over Dr. No, but good God, if Christmas Jones doesn't show up in the top five. I couldn't believe it. I had A View to a Kill over Dr. No. Scot-free. I had Goldfinger low. Scot-free. But, you know. Oh, Christmas Jones!
Especially, like, what movies did... Like, because you had, what, Rosie Carver and...
Nobody remembers. Only you and I, Aaron, remember that Rosie Carver was horrid.
Yeah.
I had Jinx in there. Like, and I even wrote that I prefer Christmas Jones over Jinx. I would rather her just be a terrible bit player in a movie than someone trying to upstage everyone with their scenes and being horribly inconsistent with what they want with the character.
Yep.
I would much in trying to steal thunder and draw attention to themselves. I Denise Richards is horrible, but she's just playing her part to the best of her Denise Richards' ability and not trying to take over the movie at any point.
And she's
point.
Not in that movie that much. Like, that's like...
No. No, neither is Rosie Carver, but man, it's a
yeah. She leaves an impact.
Minutes
yeah.
She gets it.
Goodnight's terrible, also. Also,
Goodnight. Yeah, I mean, when did Christmas Jones shake her butt and accidentally set off the self destruct?
Brilliant scene.
Yeah, You know, people need to go through and just. I mean, Denise Richards is more recent. I get that, but there are some terrible ones, and there's a lot of girls that Bond girls that make no sense. In the sense of the plot, either Christmas Jones, actually, I mean, on paper, she makes, you know, her character's details make a little more sense as to what she can do. But there's some like Honey Rider that make no sense as to what they're just there to be rescued.
And speaking of being rescued, I'm going to rescue us from the end of this podcast episode. Thank you, anybody that's listened to all of our Quantum of Solace commentary, all of it, including all the wild tangents. But yeah, I know I really enjoyed doing these for the past few weeks with GoldenEye and the other ones as well. Like, it's really fun to dig into Bond movies, and I hope anyone that's listened to all these commentaries enjoys it. And I hope anyone that's stuck around this long is excited for Skyfall, because I initially wanted Brandon to be a part of the Skyfall episode, and I figured, why not, since we had some time before that was happening, why not have him jump into our Out Now podcast world by doing some Bond commentaries? And of course, Scott's a friend of the show, he's been doing this for a while, so it's been nice to have you along with us for these commentaries, and I'm looking forward to next week when we finally talk about the newest Bond film. So
I look forward to it. I think you guys are both going to like it.
Yeah.
Very excited.
So with that said, that's going to do it for this special bonus episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. You can, of course, find all of my work at my personal blog, thecodeofzeke.com, where you can find all my written movie reviews, as well as at ysoblue.com for more reviews and Blu-ray reviews. And you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/AaronsPS3. Scott?
Mendelsohn's Memos. Scott Allen Mendelsohn at blogspot.com.
And Brandon?
At BT Peters and also Mendelsohn's Memos.
I look forward to whatever series you choose as your next extensive retrospective article look at, so we'll see. But, you can find all the other episodes, the regular episodes of Out Now with Aaron and Abe. Out Now is a weekly movie review podcast, but, at iTunes, also at hhwlod.com. You can email us at outnowpodcast@gmail.com. You can, you know, more thoughts on Quantum of Solace or any of the Bond movies in general or what you're things about Bond, any questions you have, you know, feel free to email about that. Facebook.com/outnowpodcast and twitter.com/outnow_podcast. Follow and like those pages. You can find all our episodes and updates and pictures and what have you there. And yeah, until next time, James Bond will return with Skyfall with us reviewing it that weekend. And that's going to do it. So long and good night.
Oh,